Hello, everyone. Today is October 27th, 2024, and we yet again have a special guest back on the show, Laith Marouf. Laith joins us from Lebanon. He is an award-winning journalist and political commentator. Laith has been working in media since 1999. Laith is also one of the creators and producers of the volunteer TV station and news outlet Free Palestine TV, which can be found on all social media platforms and via freepalestine.video. Free Palestine TV is the, or excuse me, Free Palestine not only has the best analysis of what is going on in Palestine of any English language news outlet, but they are one of the best sources of news from the front lines. Free Palestine TV is now putting out several videos per day from the front lines of Palestine, including the West Bank and also Lebanon. Due to the fact that it is so difficult to get reliable and accurate news from the mainstream media in the West, we are very grateful to have Laith join us on Activist News Network for a weekly news update on Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation and genocidal campaign against Palestine. Laith, thank you for coming back on the show and welcome back to Activist News Network.
Great to be with you, Raven and Chris. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So before we get into anything, you have been a frontline reporter, Laith, and a witness to genocidal war that has been expanding and escalating, putting your life at even greater risk. We wanted to check in about you and your loved ones' well-being before going into your analysis of the latest developments. So how are you, Laith?
Well, for now, we're safe. Obviously, the war is expanding and more areas of Lebanon are being attacked. But for now, we're safe. Schools here are all online, at least the private schools. The public schools are all closed. And that's because many of the public schools have been turned into a housing of displaced people in Lebanon. We'll see where things go, but it looks like this is going to be a long war.
Thank you for sharing, Laith, and we're happy to hear that you and your loved ones are safe for the time being, and hoping that continues, obviously. So we wanted to ask you about the Israeli occupation army's strike against Iran in the early morning hours of Saturday, October 26th. According to most Western media outlets, Israel's Air Force carried out precision strikes, so-called precision strikes, targeting strategic military sites, including ballistic missile manufacturing and air defense batteries. However, we're hearing from non-Western media and sources that that Israel's strikes yesterday were mostly, if not entirely, a failure. So, Laith, what are you hearing?
Well, hearing from the Iranian official sources, Iran has already announced at least four air defense system officers and soldiers that were martyred in these attacks. We also have now tens of videos that came out from inside Iran of the Israeli missiles being intercepted in the air by Iranian air defenses, with very few of them reaching their targets. And you could tell from those videos the difference between Israeli air defenses, or Western NATO air defenses, and Iranian air defenses, because you could see that the Iranians are using a different kind of anti-air projectiles that explode in the air close to the whatever object is they're trying to intercept. So that guarantees that even if there's no direct impact between the two missiles, that the coming projectile will be exploded and unable to reach its target. So Clearly, the Iranians have designed their systems in a different way, and it's more effective than the Western NATO air systems. And we remember from October 1st, Iran's retaliation for the assassination of Sheikh Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, how the hypersonic missiles were almost totally unintercepted by the NATO systems stationed in the Zionist colony. So, yes, the Israelis were able to infiltrate the airspace of Iran through these missiles. But again, it's also important for our viewers to remember that this was not an Israeli attack. This was an attack conducted by all NATO's might. There was at least 10 American jet fuel refilling planes up in the air over Jordan and Iraq in order to allow these Israeli jets, if they were even Israeli, to actually conduct the attack on Iran. So it's another clear indication that Israel is not an equal competitor to Iran. It has been degraded in the category. Iran is a regional superpower, while Israel is the protectorate. It's not even a power in the region anymore. It has to have direct American and NATO involvement in its protection. And so it's ceased to be even a province of the empire. It is, or a vessel. It's a total protectorate. We will see now how Iran responds, but Iran has already announced that it will be retaliating, especially given that there is martyred soldiers of its military forces and a few of those air defense systems that were hit, and at least one base that the Iranians said received minor damage. So that's overall, we can say that this attempt by the Zionists to save face actually degraded their stature even more and exposed them as incapable of fighting Iran directly by themselves and or maintaining the existence of the colony as a whole without the direct protection of the imperial forces.
Thank you, Laith. I appreciate that. Of course, the Western media lets us know that the Israeli occupation army continues to pound both Palestine and Lebanon with bombs and other weapons of war, targeting not just civilians, but hospitals, schools, refugee camps, and other sites that are considered war crimes and crimes against humanity under so-called international law. However, we are not hearing much in the Western media about the Palestinian resistance formations or the axis of resistance. So, Laith, starting with the Palestinian resistance factions, what should our audience know about their resistance to Israeli genocide and occupation from this past week, including, as you mentioned before the show, recent operation conducted by someone coming from the 1948 region?
Yes, the latest that you just mentioned earlier in the morning, a Palestinian citizen of the colony, meaning he carries an Israeli passport, drove a truck, semi, 18-wheeler kind of situation, through a crowd of Israeli soldiers and Mossad agents that were lined up outside the Glilot air base, military base on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. The Glilot military base has been a target of Hezbollah and Iran for many times, but also it is where Unit 8200, responsible for the electronic warfare and all the online propaganda that we see with the bots and so forth, is stationed there. So this truck drove through this crowd of Israeli soldiers and Mossad agents waiting for their transport bus. It's a specialized bus that takes them to their homes so nobody knows who they are or sees their names, and rammed through them, took at least 40 of them under. Already the Israeli authorities have announced 9 of those 40 are dead, and many are in critical condition. The video is out there now from multiple angles, those security cameras showing how this brave man, you know, conducted this operation and was very successful in taking out these war criminals. You know, it is also an indication, number one, of the fact that Palestinians inside 1948 territories that have been kind of marginalized completely since the beginning of the Al-Aqsa flood and the genocide in Gaza, have been oppressed and monitored extensively because the Israelis were worried about that the Palestinians inside 48 territories would join the overall uprising, rebellion that is happening in the West Bank and in Gaza. And what we can see is that the Zionist intelligence were unable to predict or know that this man was going to you know, conduct this operation. And the fact that he targeted Unit 8200 and the military intelligence and Mossad, that's actually even a bigger success in this operation, because these are the people that would have been responsible to hunt this man and any other Palestinians that may think of resisting the occupation that are inside 1948 territories. So, you know, he's a martyr right now. Many of the, almost practically all the Palestinian resistance groups and parties have issued statements of congratulations to the Palestinian people on this very precise operation, and condolences to the family of the martyr war hero that conducted it. When we talk about Gaza, over the last week, the Israelis have been concentrating their genocidal actions on the north in the Jabalia region. And we all watched, obviously, the mass expulsions, mass roundups, and the mass murder of unarmed Palestinians. We watched, of course, the doctors and nurses of the Kamal Adwan Hospital being taken out of the hospital, stripped naked, and then rounded up in a pit. And you know, we don't know what happened to them since then, but most probably they were all murdered and covered in this pit. We saw videos and statements of the Israelis rounding up children, babies, from the Kamal Adwan Hospital and areas around it, and throwing them all in a pit and making their mothers watch as an Israeli tank drove circles around this pit and the sand compounding over the children until all their bones were broken. And then the Israelis pulling out these babies out of the pit, and whoever was still alive threw them like a ball onto their mother and said, "Get out of here." And obviously the majority of the babies were killed. I mean, it's hard to even say this story. I don't think many, I don't think any sources in the West reported it. On the other hand, the Palestinian resistance inside Jabalia has been, you know, impossible to describe. They managed to locate the commanding officer in charge of the whole operation and all his deputies and guards and liquidate them all. And that this is the, you know, highest ranking Israeli officer to be killed on the grounds of Gaza. And he's been responsible for many of the massacres in the south and other parts of Gaza previously. So that was a huge success. We see every day the Israelis announce two or four Israeli soldiers and officers killed in the Jabalia front. So this is a really tiny zone that has been blockaded now for a couple of weeks, starved, and it's bombarded relentlessly. And, you know, four different battalions are invading it, and it's still unconquered. And the what we see is that a year and 13 months after the genocide started, the Israelis are unable to conquer such a small little part of Gaza. And this is why they are opting out, as we see in all of Gaza, in all of Palestine, in Lebanon even. They're opting out to the total ethnic cleansing option and carpet bombing of areas because they know that they cannot militarily win. So their only plan, it seems like, and it's been proven now for these 13 months, is their only plan militarily is for genocide.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's an incredibly heavy story, and we appreciate you bringing it here to the Activist News Network. To follow up, we wanted to also ask you about the martyrdom of Yahya Sinwar, the powerful and intelligent Hamas leader and architect of Operation Alaska Flood, who died on October 18th, fighting an invading Israeli occupation force on the front lines in Rafah. Laith, what was your reaction to the death of Sinwar?
Obviously, in the first minutes when it was announced, we were all like waiting for proof of it. And the Israelis made the mistake of actually providing this proof of showing the video to the world, thinking that they would be undermining this man and or making him look less worthy of this battle. And clearly the majority of humanity, when they watch this video of a man with one arm sitting dignified on a couch after having a pitched battle with his invading force, chasing away an Israeli drone with whatever he has around him, that stick, which is many people now are kind of referring to it as Moses' stick, Moses' staff. So it is actually probably that image of that staff is going to haunt the Israelis till the end of the Zionist colony. And it kind of reasserted that Prophet Moses is the ancestor of the Palestinians, not of the Zionists. It reasserted that the Palestinian people, the Arabic people, it is our religious, theological heritage, the story of Moses, and not of those who, instead of heeding the Ten Commandments handed to Moses, don't kill, don't steal, don't covet your neighbor's things, are actually the antithesis of the Ten Commandments, these Zionists. They kill, they steal, they covet other people's things. I think this, the image of his martyrdom is going to live forever. It is, he definitely entered now the history books of the most glorious warriors that were martyred in their struggle for liberation of their people or for justice, and that they were killed by a very you know, unworthy opponent that doesn't respect the rules of war, or what used to be called chivalry. Okay, so here is the most advanced weapons on the planet, and they're having to chase Sinuar for 13 months, 12 months, and finally to have such a big battle to get him. it proves how much of a great warrior he was. Last thing I would say about Sinuar is that this man was a Palestinian refugee from Ascalon, or what the Zionists call Ashkelon. They like to Hebrewize the names of our locations. And he was born as a refugee, spent most of his life in Israeli prisons. During his time in Israeli prisons, built the basis of what we know as the Palestinian prisoner movement, was close to many of the leaders of the resistance, no matter what their political background is or political party are. And when he was liberated in a prisoner exchange deal with the Zionists years ago, he vowed that he will do all he can and spend the rest of his life fighting for the liberation of other Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli dungeons. And he spent his time planning Al-Aqsa flood in order to deliver on his promise that he will liberate Palestinian prisoners through another exchange deal with the Zionist, similar to that got him his freedom. And ultimately, he definitely delivered on his promise. He did all he can, and he gave his life to Palestinian prisoners. And this is what the Zionists want us to forget, that this is actually the difference between a Palestinian and an Israeli. Palestinians are willing to be martyred in order to liberate their prisoners. Israelis are willing to kill their own prisoners rather than liberate a Palestinian prisoner. You see the difference? We are willing to die, to be genocided completely, and never forget our Palestinian prisoners, which we refer to as living martyrs. Palestinian prisoners are the ones that, from our society, that are paying the highest price during their lifetime for our freedom. Those who are martyred have a less of a sacrifice than having to live as a living martyr inside Israeli dungeon. And Yahya Sinwar embodied all that. And this is why for a whole year, the Israelis were offering millions of dollars to any Palestinian that can locate him or help them locate him. And not one Palestinian stepped forward to betray this glorious man, because everybody understood that this is a principled man that is doing his best for his people. So glory to martyr Yahya Sinwar, and freedom to all our prisoners, and freedom to Palestine, inshallah, very soon.
Definitely appreciate those comments. And just noting here, he was not found, in fact, but he opened fire with only two men with him in order to try to liquidate the forces that were eventually to surround him. Going from that now, Laith, turning to Lebanon, this past week it was reported in Western media outlets that the Israeli occupation army has continued both its bombing campaign and its ground invasion of Lebanon. Laith, as someone living in and reporting from the front lines in Lebanon, What is the latest that our audience should be aware of regarding Israel's war on Lebanon and in terms of Hezbollah's resistance from the past week or so?
I think the most important thing that happened over the last 24 hours is Hezbollah releasing a video with a Hebrew message, completely Hebrew, no English. And in it, they order residents, colonists in 25 somewhat Israeli colonies in the north of Palestine, stretching from Nahariya on the coastline to the Golan Heights, to immediately evacuate those colonies because the Israeli military is using those colonies as hideouts for their soldiers. So they gave the colonists till today to evacuate because these colonies will be carpet bombed and totally leveled to the ground, just like the Israelis are leveling to the ground much of the Lebanese villages that are right on the border. So this is the first time ever that such a threat warning is given by any Arabic army or militia in the history of this struggle. So we clearly are in a different stage now. It is now the time that Hezbollah tells people to evacuate locations. You know, the Zionists were very cute, always sending messages to people in buildings that you have to leave and or doing those double tap bombings. Well, Hezbollah is now doing that. And so anyone that was okay with the idea that the Israelis can warn and then bomb and then blame any victims of this bombing for not heeding the warnings of the Zionists now should be willing to accept any Zionist colonists that die in Hezbollah's bombardments of these colonies and consider them as collateral damage. They shouldn't be named even, probably, just like the you know, Palestinian and Lebanese victims are not named in such cases. On the ground, the battle is very, very intense. The Zionists have, on average, are announcing around 20 Israeli soldiers dead a day on the front here in Lebanon. The Hezbollah fighters are fighting pitched battles in the destroyed villages on the front line that are completely destroyed. The Israelis can't enter even these villages without coming under fire. They lost close to 30 somewhat Merkava tanks in this period of 20 somewhat days that since they began the attempted invasion of South Lebanon. And the Hezbollah fighters not only are ambushing the Israelis when they invade, but they're also hitting all their gathering locations on the other side of the border before they attempted invasion. So they're under constant fire, the Zionists. And you know, it's good for our viewers to remember that in 1982, the Israelis reached Beirut in 4 days. And in 2006, it took them 33 days, but they reached the third line of villages. Today we're now 22, 23 days since the beginning of the invasion, and the Israelis haven't been able to cross the front first line villages, which means that they are in a worse situation than they were even in 2006, and that the Hezbollah's capabilities and fighters are much more advanced than even in 2006. The last thing I would say about this is that the Israelis are conducting their war from the air. That's what they've been doing in Gaza also, for the most part. But this is not a way you can invade a country like Lebanon through. you have to be on the ground. And the Israelis originally sent four corpses, four army corps, meaning, you know, around 15,000 soldiers each. And in the 3-4 days ago, they added two more corpses. So now we're around 100,000 Israeli soldiers, if not a little bit more than that, that are trying to invade with all their machinery, and they can't enter. This is a number that's much larger than even in 2006 attempted invasion. So the Israelis don't have much more corpses that are free to be moved to the north. They have another five or six inside Gaza, and another five or six inside the West Bank. That's all their army. And they can't move anything outside the West Bank because the resistance will immediately probably move on the Israeli positions inside the West Bank and or the Israeli colonies that will be unprotected, basically. And also they can't withdraw from Gaza because, as we see, the minute they withdraw a little bit from any region in Gaza, it's back under full control of the resistance. So they've reached their limits of what they can do with ground forces. And this is why now we are hearing that there is mercenaries coming in to fill this gap. And some of these mercenaries are from Ukraine, from Turkey. And of course, it's all along for the last 13 months, the American special forces, Canadian special forces, British, French, Italian, German, they're all on the ground and active both in Gaza and inside Lebanon, but it's still not helping Israel achieve any military goals.
Thank you for filling us in on that. And for our listeners, we here at Activist News Network have heard that there have been over 700 casualties since beginning the ground infiltrations into Lebanon on the Israeli side. But moving on, Laith, we wanted to ask you about the October 19th reports of a Hezbollah drone launched from Lebanon that targeted the private home of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, located in the coastal city of located 60 kilometers north of Tel Aviv. Laith, how significant was this drone attack on Netanyahu's private residence?
It was very, very significant, and for multiple reasons. One of them being, obviously, the intelligence that was needed to know where is the private residence of Netanyahu. This is not like a state property or something that the prime minister resides in. This is a private stolen home from a Palestinian that Netanyahu resides with his family in. And the other thing that is very significant about it is that the drone made it through all the air defense systems and was filmed by the Israeli colonists being chased by F-15s, F-16s, and helicopters, and all of them failing to take down this drone. And finally, that the drone actually hit the window of Netanyahu's bedroom. So they not only knew where the house is, they knew where the bedroom is and which window it is, and hit the drone through it, and that it got its target. So this is like pinpoint accuracy, also to the meter. You know, the window is not wider than a meter, so, or a couple of meters, whatever it is. The other thing that we note from this is that it shows how advanced Hezbollah's drone operators are. I mean, I don't think the U.S. has any drone operators that are this skilled. to be able to have dogfights in the air with F-15s, F-16s, and helicopters, and to hit such a small target, that's impressive. If there is world championships for drone operators, clearly Hezbollah will win that. And the other thing that we should note about it is that the Israelis, because this operation was successful, the Israelis got freaked out. They don't know how even Hezbollah is communicating with these drones. So the next day there was another drone that flew over Tel Aviv for 6 hours, going back and forth in circles. And for 6 hours, all the Israeli air defenses and their air power, jets and helicopters, couldn't take it down. And the Israelis even had jammed all GPS over Tel Aviv, jammed all communication, thinking that, you know, they'll be able to cut the communication between the operator and the drone, and they didn't succeed. The drone actually eventually went and hit a military target in the Glilot base that we were just talking about earlier with that ramming operation. So this is very sophisticated technical specifications that the Israelis don't have a defense against. And I don't think anybody even, have shown this use of whatever communication technology that the drone has with the operator on any other battlefield. We didn't see the Ukrainians complain, for instance, that they can't jam Russian drones. We didn't hear that the Russians complain about not being able to jam Ukrainian drones. So this is another indicator of how technologically advanced Hezbollah is, and the innovations of its engineers and programmers that are proven things that, you know, showing us things we've never seen.
Quite impressive indeed. Turning now to the question of Israel's intentional targeting of journalists, this past Friday, October 25th, there was an Israeli strike that targeted a site in South Lebanon where 18 staff members from over 7 different media organizations were present. In that strike, Israel assassinated 3 Lebanese journalists in what has been described as an intentional targeted assassination. They killed also 3 members of the Al-Mayadeen and Al-Manar TV crews and injured many others. Laith, why do you think it is, or why would Israel be intentionally targeting journalists for assassination? And is there more about this news that our audience should be aware of?
Yes, so this was a chalet, kind of summer chalet compound with multiple units that the journalists from Lebanon and the Arabic region were renting the different chalets for their crews. This location was given the coordinates to the UNIFEL, the United Nations, the Red Cross, all of that, and the UNIFEL and the Red Cross convey the location to all the warring parties, saying this is where the journalists are. And that's where journalists have been doing their live reporting from the south, showing the operations from a distance. This is far away from the front line, but it's from a high point that is overviewing the operations. So the Israelis knew exactly which chalet had Al-Mayadeen and Al-Manar reporters in. According to the testimony of one of the survivors of Al-Mayadeen reporters in the special that she did for Al-Mayadeen TV that I watched, the cameraman and of Al-Mayadeen and his engineer, as well as the cameraman of Al-Manar, were sitting outside the chalet in a roofed front porch, basically. And the missile went through the roof of this porch and hit them directly. So it was intended to kill them immediately. It's not like they were just hitting the house in general, and they're like, okay, we hope that they die, these Al-Mayadeen and Al-Manar journalists. They could see them probably directly sitting on the chairs outside on the porch when they were hit. It's intentional because the Israelis hate the fact that Al-Mayadeen specifically is doing an amazing job informing the Arabic public. It's the only pan-Arab news station, television news station, that is pro-resistance and has been able to really destroy any of the propaganda that the rest of the Gulf TV stations were spewing against the resistance. And Al-Manar television is the local Lebanese TV station that is affiliated to Hezbollah. And again, it's very pro-resistance. So they were targeted for their work and their achievements and their ability to reach the public and destroy the propaganda of the Zionists. And I would say in comparison, this morning we all watched on the Israeli television, one of the national TV stations, their reporter live from one of the Lebanese frontline villages inside with the Israeli soldiers, and the Israeli soldiers and commanders there giving him the button to blow up Lebanese homes and schools. And he was joyous to participate in the in the conduction of a war crime live on television. This is the difference between our journalists that are being martyred here in Lebanon and in Palestine, who work to convey the truth and the fact from the ground of the battle. And on the other hand, the Israeli journalists and the Western journalists in general are actually participating directly in the affairs of the war and are conducting war crimes themselves. And so this is true also for, this guy Moray, whatever his name is, the British quote-unquote journalist, Craig Moray or something, right? It was filmed himself inside the home that where Yahya Sinwar was assassinating, sitting on the couch with Israeli soldiers around him. Remember, we were told Western journalists are not allowed into Gaza. It seems like only propagandists that are willing to be involved in the conduction of war crimes are allowed in Gaza and or in South Lebanon. So, when the Israelis claim that journalists in Gaza and or Lebanon are affiliated with resistance groups, like we saw the death threat to 8 journalists in the north of Gaza in Jabalia area, all of them being claimed to be Hamas or Islamic Jihad by the Israeli army. In reality, this is a confession that all Israeli journalists and all Western journalists are part and parcel of intelligence and military forces of the empire and Zionism.
Thank you for that. And, as a frontline reporter yourself, we wanted to ask, like, how fearful are you of being targeted by, and you and your family of being targeted by, for assassination by Israel?
Well, everything is possible with such enemy. I mean, I would like to think that there's many more important journalists than I am that will be higher in the hit list. But you never know. At the same time, last week, the Zionist regime published a report. And in that report, claimed that there's 4 people around the West that are the biggest enemies of Zionism, and quote unquote, they are anti-Semites and that they would like to get them. And they delivered it to the Canadian government. And there's only four people on this list. And I am one of the four. I mean, as a joke, I feel like it's a humiliation to all the media activists around the world that Israel could only come up with four names on a list. Can't even make it into top five or top 10. So it's a condemnation, actually, of the media activist scene in the West in general. It also is surprising because they didn't do such a list or statement about anybody in the US, anybody in the UK, Australia, anywhere in the planet. They targeted four individuals in Canada. So it makes me wonder, is there also no worthy names in those other countries that they believe are a threat to them, a challenge to their ability to continue conducting genocide? Or is it actually that the Zionist Canadian lobby is so powerful, it's more powerful than the American Zionist lobby or British or Australian, that it can weigh in on the Israeli government to issue such a statement? So it could be either that everybody is not worth the mentioning outside, and or that the Zionists in Canada are so central within the global Zionist mechanisms that they can order such a statement to be published while their compatriots in the other countries can't. If I feel that there is some threat becoming more serious, I will move my family, that's for sure. I would not want the Zionists to have the pleasure of killing all my children and my wife. I am ready to be martyred. And it will be an honor to be on the list of names that were martyred for the liberation of Palestine. But that's not my primary goal. Okay. I am receiving death threats on a daily basis, both on phone and on email. And you can see on public social media the constant death threats, specifically coming from Canadian Zionists. Will they prioritize assassinating me? I don't know, but these are crazy people.
Thank you, Laith, and we definitely want to extend our appreciation to you and our want to help in any way that we can, of course, you and your family. Is there anything else regarding the various axes of resistance factions that our audience should be aware of from this past week, or just that we haven't been able to discuss in depth?
Yeah, quickly, Hezbollah has now reached 48 operations a day. That's more than double before the invasion. The Iraqi resistance is also announcing around 12, 14, sometimes 18 operations a day. These are wild numbers. It used to be like 2-4 operations a day. The Yemeni military and Yemeni Navy announced that they are conducting full exercises, and they are already in the act of them. They've released some videos of those exercises for the possibility of, on the one hand, defending Yemen from any invading NATO or Israeli force, and for the possibility of having to conduct an invasion of Palestine. So we're that's like, overall, we are at a stage of military operations unseen. It's like at least double, if not triple, the actions that we've saw, you know, 20 some more years days ago before the invasion of Lebanon. And finally, I would say about Free Palestine TV, we're launching a unit reporting from Jordan. You know, we've been concentrating since the beginning to cover the seldomly covered areas of and we haven't been trying to do breaking news or something like that. We're trying to document areas of this war and subjects that are not covered in the mainstream, even in the activist media. So just like we're doing all these reports from the West Bank about the daily attacks on Palestinians and so forth that nobody's covering, and or what's happening here in Lebanon, we're going to be doing that now from Jordan. We hope to bring everybody in the world a view into the Jordanian people's valiant resistance to the genocide and the collaboration of their government with the genocide in Palestine. Please visit our website, freepalestine.video, donate, subscribe, so we can continue doing this work.
Thank you guys for all the hard work you do. And I just want to urge our audience, who, and knowing that we consistently are getting over 10,000 views on these interviews, to turn those eyeballs onto Free Palestine TV on YouTube and check out some of the amazing work that's being done there. So Laith, we also wanted to ask you about the supposed leak of highly classified U.S. intelligence about Israel's plans for retaliation against Iran. What was your reaction to this news and the leak that came out last Sunday on October 20th?
Yeah, I mean, it's it looked like a test balloon, a propaganda thing. It didn't really look like it's real. I mean, obviously, we live in an AI and deep fake kind of times, so you can produce things that look official. But we ultimately, I feel it was directed towards the Western audience, just to kind of make them feel that, look, we're not going to go to World War III yet. Okay, calm down. The elections, you know, are really stressing the American elite. And as we saw, according to Western media outlets, the same ones that produced this leak, the Israelis didn't attack nuclear or oil infrastructure. So it was just kind of preparing the audience for what's going to happen. At the same time, to make the audience, well, America got what it wants, Israel got what it wants, and Iran got a hit. But no need to worry about a full-out world war. So we'll see now what they produce after Iran retaliates to the attack.
Thank you for that, Laith. We also wanted to connect two different stories together about Turkey's strikes against U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in both Syria and Iraq. First, it was reported on Wednesday, October 23rd, that Turkey bombed U.S. proxies in northeast Syria following a, quote, terror attack, unquote, in Ankara. Apparently, Turkey conducted several airstrikes and artillery shellings across the U.S.-controlled north and east of Syria late on October 23rd, targeting positions held by the Kurdish-Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. And on Friday, October 25th, it was reported that Turkish warplanes carried out airstrikes on sites belonging to the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, and other affiliated forces in northern Iraq's Sinjar region, killing five people. Laith, what should our audience be aware of regarding these Turkish attacks in Syria and Iraq, and how does this factor into the other wars taking place in West Asia?
Well, first thing that we should note is that the terrorist attack in Ankara happened at the same time that Erdogan and Turkey were at the BRICS Astana meeting. So it is partially a message from NATO and the West about Turkey having to watch itself as it gets closer to BRICS. The other thing to note about this terrorist attack was that it was conducted against the largest drone manufacturer in Turkey. So this is the company that is selling drones to Russia to use in their war in Ukraine. So again, you could see the NATO connection to the design of this operation. And so it sent multiple messages to Turkey. One, don't get too close to BRICS. Two, stop supplying Russia with drones that are being used to defeat the Ukrainian military and allied forces with it. The last thing we should note is that, unfortunately, the PKK of the 1970s is not the PKK of today. Okay, the PKK used to be a communist, anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist party. And this is why Syria for decades hosted the leadership of the PKK and camps for training them during the time when Öcalan was still free. And Syria risked even being invaded by Turkey in the early 2000s. The Syrian people suffered tremendously when Turkey built 40 somewhat dams on the Euphrates and Tigris to cut the water to Syria and Iraq as a punishment for Syria protecting Öcalan and the PKK. And we look today, the PKK has turned into completely a CIA tool. And instead of being a force for the liberation of Kurdish people in their homelands of the Kurdistan mountain ranges inside Turkey, it became an occupation force of Syrian land, Syria that hosted them and housed them and fed them and educated them for generations, and became a colonizing force that ethnically cleanses Syrian citizens from their lands in northeast Syria to be colonized by invading Kurdish death squads. So while some in the left in the West are still remembering the PKK of the 70s, they must come to the realization of what is the reality now on the ground. So Turkey bombarding Syrian territory and Iraqi territory to hit these Kurdish Contras, in Arabic we would call it two clay pots breaking each other, or, you know, knocking heads. And meaning, I'm not a clay pot. These are two NATO allies or vessels, the Kurdish Contras and Turkey itself are both, and they are knocking each other. So for me as a Syrian, for anybody who's anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist, anti-Zionist, we shouldn't care a minute for the well-being of these Kurdish Contras and or their, you know, squabbles in the shed outside the master's house.
Thank you for that insight. To quickly zoom out for a bit, we wanted to ask you about BRICS and the summit that was held this past week in the Russian city of Kazan. We know that the senior Hamas official, Musa Abu Mazouk, praised Russia during his trip to the to Russia this past week, saying that Russia's stance on Palestine is commendable. Leith, what's your reaction to this praise from Hamas of Russia?
Well, you know, clearly Russia did what it can other than entering a military battle on behalf of the Palestinians. We can look at their conduct at the Security Council and the statements that they come out from them. You know, they're using language that we haven't heard since the 70s, since Khrushchev time. And so there's a huge change in the position of Russia publicly. And it's, you know, used to be trying to stay, you know, both siding. It's not anymore. The other thing that we should note from here is that after this statement and after the meeting, there was a high-ranking delegation of the Russian Foreign Affairs and military that flew to the Zionist colony to try to negotiate a ceasefire. You see, everybody hears about ceasefire negotiations that the Americans and the Qataris are leading, blah, blah, blah. Now it's the first time we see that Russia throws itself in as a mediator. And clearly they are more balanced than the Zionist White House. So we haven't seen any response from the Israelis and or details about the peace offer or whatever ceasefire offer that the Russians brought with them. But this must have been negotiated and written in the presence of Hamas in the BRICS meeting. So, you know, will it come out with anything in terms of will the Israelis follow through? I don't think so. But at least Russia is showing itself right now as an international leader that is trying to fill the gap with the retreat of the American empire and the total unmasking of its bias as a mediator, the U.S. And we can put it in the same context of China moving in the region to you know, solve conflicts between regional countries like it did with Iran and the Saudi Kingdom.
So with that in mind, from the perspective of the Palestinian resistance forces, is there relevance to this BRICS summit, or is it, as some are saying, an irrelevant event?
It's relevant because it's creating a new world where the United States and its Western provinces, European provinces, whatever it is, have no say. And this means, you know, peoples, nations, states can speak to each other directly without that Western filter in between. And just having a BRICS financial system competing to SWIFT, filling that gap, that will change reality in Palestine completely. I have been, for instance, Free Palestine TV has been trying to pay our employees in the West Bank. Canadian banks, although you're allowed to send money to the West Bank, the Israelis are not allowing money coming from Canada to go to banks in the West Bank. You can send money to anywhere in Israel, quote unquote Israel. So in a world where the SWIFT system is not the only exclusive system, then I would be able to send money to our employees directly from Canada to the West Bank. And that's one of the few things that, you know, many things actually that is a positive outcome of this BRICS emergence. You know, the realities now of you know, rising nations that have huge populations like Nigeria or Egypt or others that have not been able to take a stage on a global scale since, you know, colonialism. This is going to change because now the new world will be based on the weight of the country, population, and resources, natural resources, in geopolitical position, not on what language you speak or what color your skin is. So Palestine will benefit from all of this. The resistance will benefit from all of this all around the world.
Thank you for that. Those are all the questions we really have for you today. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we come to a close here?
Thank you very much, guys, for having me so many times. And I would say also wish safety to President Morales and his guards and driver who came under an assassination attempt just a few hours ago. Bolivia's former president, 14 bullets fired at his car. And that's all the United States. So death to America, as our Yemeni brothers would say. Glory to Bolivia, and our best wishes to President Morales and his compatriots that were with him in the car.
All right. Thank you so much. And looking forward to having you back.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.